From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a stunning win for Donald Trump and the GOP.
Probably what we should have reminded ourselves was, you know what, this has been 16, 18, 24 months of surprises. And so the fact that a shot came on election night, I guess, isn't so shocking after all.
There are voters that were not being represented in the polls that came out and voted in this election who had not been part of previous elections.
How the polls got it so wrong.
No one seems to care about margin of error anymore. It's just like, oh, is so-and-so up by 1 or 2 points? They're leading. Well, no, they're not.
And defeat for the RTA millage.
The empathy towards others in the region sort of got caught up in a national wave of anger and fear towards others.
Those stories and more on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, in case you haven't heard, there was an historic election last night. The Stateside staff has been getting reactions from Michiganders along the I-94 corridor.
I think we're going to be blessed. We have to trust the Lord that he's going to guide us all to make America great again.
Scared to death. Scared for me as a female and scared for my four sons who are half black. And I don't know really where we're going to go from here, but I've got a gut feeling that we're going to war. And it scares me.
I'm very pleased with the outcome of it. I'm a Donald Trump supporter, and I think we're headed in the right direction. For the next 4 years, I see the country coming together again. I see us united and putting America first and being fair to all people and other countries, but putting America first is what I'm concerned about. I don't believe he bears any malice toward anybody, and I know I certainly don't.
What is, I think, the most disturbing is that nothing will be predictable. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that was the next scariest thing I've ever lived through in my life. So it's numbing.
I think it's the same old gridlock. I think Democrats who criticize Republicans for the obstructionism are now going to do it themselves.
Who won? Trump? Oh, I guess I don't really know because I haven't really followed anything.
Let's turn now to the chairman of Michigan's Republican Party, Ronna Romney McDaniel. Welcome back to Stateside. Were these results beyond what you had hoped for?
Absolutely. It's a great night all the way around. We thought we were going to keep our majority in the state house and keep our congressional delegation. And we actually thought Trump could win Michigan. But, you know, you're always nervous going into Election Day, and I think we exceeded expectations.
So what do you think was behind the victory? I mean, here we've got Michigan going to a Republican for the White House for the first time. It's 1988. Why do you think that happened?
Well, as I was traveling the state, certainly we knew we had enthusiasm on our side. And every day I would run into voters who would say, I've sat out the past three elections, but I'm coming off the bench to vote for Donald Trump. Or Union Democrats coming and saying, I'm voting for Donald Trump, or a young college student. So we knew that there was something happening, that he was expanding his coalition here in Michigan. But I do think there are voters that were not being represented in the polls that came out and voted in this election who had not been part of previous elections.
Did the results square with your own internal polls, Ronna?
Yes. Our internal polls on Friday showed Trump with a victory in Michigan of 8,000 votes. That is what our polling was showing. We knew it was tight, so that is why we pushed very hard to have Donald Trump here and Mike Pence here. Mike Pence here was here four days in a row. We knew turnout was going to be the difference maker, and boy, that modeling was pretty right on to be at 13,000 votes. We exceeded our expectations, I guess.
I'm curious, am I correct that the Michigan GOP, that the party canceled its election night party a couple of weeks ago? How come?
We never canceled an election night party. We hosted a combined election night party with Brooks Patterson in Oakland County. I don't know where that news story came from, actually. It's kind of a false news story, but we had a great party down in Waterford. I will say I didn't do a massive $100,000 party because every dollar I had, I wanted to put towards candidate assistance. I am a fiscally conservative chair, and it looks like we made the right decision.
Ronna, you know that there are people who are not celebrating a Donald Trump victory today, and they've heard things that he said during the campaign, and they're worried. What do you say to them?
Well, certainly we do need to heal as a nation. And Donald Trump, I think, made great strides last night with his gracious speech and reaching out to Secretary Clinton. And then today seeing President Obama give his speech and Secretary Clinton give her speech. We need to bring this country together. We can't continue under the divisiveness and the vitriol. And Donald Trump's going to have to lead the way.
What are your top three plans and priorities moving forward, Rana?
Oh, that's too much right now. I wanted to keep the state house, keep our congressional delegation, our Supreme Court, and win the White House. And we swept all that, and we got some education boards on top of that. So right now, I'm just thinking about when am I going to get to sleep for a little while.
There's a lot of folks that feel that. Overall, what do you feel that last night means for Michigan, looking ahead for the state of Michigan?
Well, it means voters are very happy with what Republican leadership has done in Michigan, with the leadership of our governor, Rick Snyder, and our Senate and our House. They really have turned our state around, adding 475,000 new jobs and taking our unemployment to 4.6%. We have turned our state into the comeback state. And the theme of our campaign was protect the comeback. And voters said, yes, we want Republican leadership in Lansing to continue doing what they've been doing.
Rana Romney McDaniel, chairman of the Michigan GOP, thanks for being with us. And hopefully some sleep is coming very soon.
Very soon. Thank you.
Thank you. We asked Michigan Democratic Chair Brandon Dillon to come on the show to give a reaction. We did not receive a reply. Many Americans were stunned, blindsided by Donald Trump's victory. And that's largely because months and months of polls pointed to a defeat for our new president-elect. Let's talk about those polls as we say hello to Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service. Why did the polls get it so wrong?
There were a few warning signs of this about a week out. Some Republican consultants did say their surveying was showing it tightening up. I started diving fairly deep into the absentee ballot numbers, and you could see there was this huge surge of absentee votes relative to 4 years ago outstate, and that the absentee vote in Oakland and Wayne counties was lagging, which were obviously critical counties for Hillary Clinton. The problem was we just didn't know if that surge of votes outstate would, although we knew that was going to be Trump territory, maybe it just represented people deciding to vote absentee instead of showing up on Election Day. So we didn't know, but you definitely felt like something could be happening. Then there was the news that the absentee vote in Detroit was off and was down. All that said, I thought, this was still going to be a three-point Clinton win of the state because, she was going to do very well in Oakland County, and she did do very well in Oakland County. The problem was for her, and the success for Donald Trump, is he just blew it away outstate. I mean, the margins he put up just dwarfed what Mitt Romney did. He turned some Democratic counties outstate in his favor, places like Bay County, Saginaw County. Even though he lost Genesee County, he kept it relatively close. And then Wayne County did not put out the margin Hillary Clinton needed. Barack Obama got something like a 350,000 vote margin out of there. Hers was nowhere near that. So when you add it all up, it's this shocking result.
I do think that based, if people, looked at polls really throughout much of this campaign, they did kind of feel that Donald Trump was going to go down in flames, and the polls got it wrong. Did they overlook crucial groups in the polls? What do you think happened?
I feel like it's deja vu all over again. There's the same discussion after the Michigan Democratic presidential primary, after Bernie Sanders shocked everybody with a win. I just think polling has a lot of problems. Now, it's just not able to model the electorate successfully, and that seems to be especially true in Michigan. There was really no reputable public survey that came out prior to the election showing Trump leading here, and it just flat out failed to model African American turnout correctly. It failed to model the rural turnout correctly, and I felt pretty strongly that we as reporters were trained to be skeptical, trust but verify everything. Mm-hmm. But what's the one thing we tend to just sort of accept on faith? I think is polls. We publish polls basically sight unseen. Did we pay for this poll? It must be true. We're going to post it. Or did a pollster that we generally know to be reputable put out this poll? We're going to report it and just take it as the God's honest truth. And I really think we need to look in the mirror. I said something similar in March, and take polling with a much bigger grain of salt when it comes to candidate versus candidate. It can still be very valuable in assessing mood on issues, but no one seems to care about margin of error anymore. It's just like, oh, is so-and-so up by 1 or 2 points? They're leading. Well, no, they're not. Now, Hillary Clinton in these polls did have a lead at the, you know, just about the margin of error, outside the margin of error, but hopefully this is the latest wake-up call, and hopefully it's a big wake-up call that we got to just use this as one piece of the puzzle and not get so obsessed with it.
You know, it's interesting. Ron French did a piece for Bridge Magazine kind of looking at what it takes to even get poll results, and only 7 to 9% of people respond to polls. It's like 1 in 12 mm-hmm. are inclined to
That's
answer.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and I stop and I think, you know what? We have fewer landlines, and we have caller ID. So people look, and, you know, where maybe 15 years ago, the phone rang, you picked it up, and you got engaged, people aren't picking up the phone.
You know, a lot of the surveys we see done don't involve dialing cell phones. Now, you know, in the past, that's overlooked millennials and young voters. Maybe it overlooked rural voters and outstate voters. Or maybe it was just a total failure to accurately model the electorate. It was too dependent on previous models, and no one thought the turnout was going to be what it was in counties like Baraga County, Roscommon County, et cetera. It's just, you know, they have a tough job, pollsters. You know, I've been fairly hard on them this year, but, you know, to their credit, you know, they put out their work and they're judged by the public. You know, not a lot of people have to deal with that in their line of work where they're going to be bashed and second-guessed. But, you know, I can only control what I do in my job, and I've tried to take a more skeptical approach to polling, and I think everybody needs to.
Zach Gorchow, Gangwon News Service. Always great talking with you. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I'm happy. I feel that it's a needful thing to change some of the direction that we were headed in. I believe that we were founded as a nation upon the commandments of God, and that we've fallen short of that. And maybe we can restore some of the problems we have in following bad legislation, especially abortion.
Over the next 4 years, I think that he will probably not be as bad as everyone thinks it's going to be, but I'm not sure that he's smart enough to make it better.
I'm upset that Trump got the election and won. I was really hoping, I didn't like him or Hillary, so I voted for an independent party myself, because I think we need a complete change in government.
I'm absolutely disappointed in my state for the decision that they made. I think a lot of voters in the northern counties who had been diehard labor supporters have abandoned the Democratic Party for reasons that I don't truly understand.
I mean, I didn't vote for either of the two candidates, two lead candidates. I voted for Jill Stein. I can understand you have people that are upset in the state about losing their jobs in the manufacturing industry, so I understand.
Well, I wait on everybody every day. So I see the crowd that probably voted for him. And just like everybody's saying, the key point is uneducated. Uneducated white males voted for this man. Uneducated. That should say something right there. We look like a bunch of fools now.
More reactions from Michiganders to yesterday's election results, and we'll be sharing more of those with you throughout the show. Detroit has itself a new school board, chosen from a field of 63 candidates. Let's talk more about the 7 winners and what's ahead for them. Bridge Magazine reporter Chastity Pratt-Dossi, welcome.
Hello.
This marks a new chapter in Detroit school board history, the first Detroit Public Schools Community District Board of Education. What do we know about the 7 winners?
Well, we know that only one person from the prior school board was elected, which I thought there would be more, but there was only one. Lamar Lemons was previously a president of the school board, and his wife also elected to the school board. Little name recognition there with Misha Stallworth being elected. Her grandmother, of course, is Alma Stallworth. And, you know, a couple folks with name recognition were not elected, Reverend David Murray being one of them. So we've got a really interesting group here.
And I guess the big understanding we all want to get is, what are they tasked with doing, and how much power does this board have?
Well, this board is tasked with doing what most school boards do as far as finding a superintendent, hiring a superintendent, and creating academic policy for the school district at large. And so the difference, though, is they will have a financial review commission. The same financial review commission that oversees the city of Detroit will be overseeing this school board's budget and also making key decisions about the CFO and the other positions. And really, that's been the whole sticking point. The school board has some authority for the first time in a decade in Detroit, which means you'll have school board meetings that are public and people can come and talk to their actual school officials. However, there is another layer of bureaucracy, an oversight board.
How long is that going to last? How long does that oversight last?
Well, the law says that the school district has to have 3 consecutive years of no deficits before this financial review commission can consider basically dissolving itself. So it, at least 3 years, probably more, I would say, because right now the district is trying to figure out how to not have a shortfall this year. So at least 3 years.
And just give us a refresher, Chastity. What's ahead for State Emergency Manager Jen Stephen Rhodes? Is he stepping down soon?
He will be stepping down as soon as the school board takes office in January.
And then will there be a new manager, or will it be the board with this Financial Review Commission?
It'll be the board with the Financial Review Commission, because remember, the law that created this new school district, this new school board, this whole new setup basically gave the school district enough money so that it is no longer in a financial emergency. Therefore, there is no longer a need for an emergency manager.
Let's talk a little bit of history. How likely do you think it is that this new board can avoid the dysfunction, we'll call it, that has historically plagued Detroit school boards?
Well, you know what? A lot of the stuff that we talk about when we talk about, you know, the problems with the Detroit School Board are problems from 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And really, what you have to do is understand that the school district is in a huge, huge financial and academic, I don't want to say doldrums, but it's you know, it's dire straits in Detroit. And the way that the school board moves forward without becoming, you know, one of those known for infighting is by focusing on what's next. The school district, if it doesn't get its act together, is going to be right in the crosshairs of everyone who wants to see the whole district chartered. So they have to focus on figuring out how to move forward and how to, you know, get test scores up and educate more kids.
So basically, that's the measure of success, isn't it?
The measure of success is the same across the nation. How well are your children achieving? And Detroit is not doing very well right now. And if they can focus, if this board can focus on a school improvement plan that will have, you know, high expectations and a lot of support for the students and staff and actually, you know, move the needle. When they move the needle and just focus on moving the needle, then, you know, that'll be success.
Chastity Pratt-Dossie, as always, thanks so much.
Anytime.
The Regional Transit Authority millage. If you favored it, you saw a big step toward the connected regional transportation system that has never happened in Southeast Michigan. If you opposed it, you saw a tax hike for services you likely don't need or care about. Well, the opposition won. Southeast Michigan voters said no to the RTA millage. Megan Owens of Transportation Riders United joins us now via Skype. As you look at the counties, Megan, Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Washtenaw, what have you learned about who supported the millage and who was against?
Well, I guess we weren't overly surprised at the general directions. Washtenaw County supported it. Oakland and Wayne counties were roughly split, each of them, and Macomb County opposed it. When push came to shove, that's where all of the counties were heading.
So what is the lesson here? Should the rest of Southeast Michigan try to work out a regional transit plan without Macomb County?
I think there's still a lot of questions about where we go from here. I don't expect that to be the direction. I think more of what we need to do is look at how do we both develop a plan where people can see and understand their benefit, whether they're in Macomb County or anywhere else in the region, and see if we can come up with something that works better for more people to understand. I mean, ultimately, this was a challenging election. Not only we knew going in that a lot of people don't ride transit and don't have a personal connection with it, and that we were asking for a tax, which is always difficult. What I don't think we expected is how this call for coming together as a region and for helping make sure sort of the empathy towards others in the region sort of got caught up in a national wave of anger and fear towards others. It was very hard to push back against that overall national trend when we're pushing a message of coming together.
Well, Megan, how much of this is about race?
I don't know. I don't know what people's reasons were, and I think we will certainly dig further into the numbers to see if there's anything we can understand there. There's a lot to be considered, but I think we had a strong plan that would have provided a lot of benefits. There was a great deal of support. This was extremely close. 18,000 vote difference in almost 2 million votes, but clearly we did not do enough of helping people understand the benefits and the need for it, especially in this the national trends we were up against.
Megan, there had to be some horse trading and dealing that had to happen when Oakland and Macomb nearly pulled out of the group. Did that compromise things at all in your view?
I don't think so. I think the changes that were made over the summer to get Macomb and Oakland County support for putting this on the ballot provided even greater benefits to some of the northern communities that felt like they weren't getting enough, provided more oversight to people who were concerned with how this might be implemented. I don't think those changes hurt anything. It was disappointing that the Oakland and Macomb leadership wouldn't get behind this plan and articulate what the benefits were for their communities.
What do you think now? I know you have to, RTA cannot try for another millage for 2 more years. So in that time, I'm wondering what you think most has to be reworked, the structure of the plan or the messaging to voters?
There definitely needs to be a combination. We've already heard a lot of feedback that people just didn't know enough, that there hadn't been enough outreach. Transit is still pretty new. Regional transit, four-county transit is a pretty new concept. And this, maybe it was an overly complicated plan, or maybe it wasn't articulated or presented in a way that people could understand. So I guess it's too early to say what would make a change moving forward.
Megan Owens with Transportation Riders United. Megan, thanks for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
One of the big decisions before Detroit voters was choosing between a pair of competing community benefits proposals. Both were aimed at making sure private developers building projects in Detroit provided certain benefits to the community that lived around the development, such as jobs, affordable housing, pollution controls. Proposal A required developers of projects valued at more than $15 million to negotiate a binding agreement with representatives of the community. Proposal B was similar, but the threshold was a lot higher, $75 million, and the neighborhood groups would have an advisory role in negotiating community benefits, not legally binding on the developer. Well, the voters chose, and Proposal B was the winner. With us now, the Reverend Joan Ross, director of the North End Woodward Community Coalition. She's one of the organizers who fought to get Proposal A on the ballot. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Why do you believe Proposal A lost?
Well, it came down to a question of money in the campaign. We did not have the kind of money that was put into the campaign. We are a grassroots organization, but I think we did a magnificent showing, and the Detroit voters stood with us, 100,000 of them.
What did you hear from voters yesterday? What message did the vote send to you?
The vote sent that definitely Detroiters believe that a community benefit agreement is necessary. An equitable part, an equitable say in development is something that Detroit voters want. So I think what we heard is that we're on the right track. We need community benefits, and there needs to be resident voice in development.
You talked about money, Reverend Ross, and the Michigan Campaign Finance Network points out that the fight against Proposal A was led by a nonprofit group called Detroit Jobs First, and it only incorporated in September and ran a real heavy schedule of ads calling Proposal A awful. And we should note, carefully not telling people to vote for Proposal B, which, under Michigan campaign finance laws, if it did, they'd have to reveal its donors. So what do you want to say about this dark money tactic?
Well, I think dark money is something that is very hard to come up against community that is voice that actually stands against community. It stands against the desires of community, the wishes that community, grassroots folks on the ground living with the situation every day, have trouble coming up against that kind of money, that kind of pressure.
Who do you believe is behind Detroit Jobs First?
Wow. That's sort of a loaded question. I would think that big development, we certainly see the names of the supporters that stood with that campaign. We see the labor unions that stood with that campaign. We see a lot of the clerical folks, a lot of the churches and religious leaders that stood with that campaign.
Well, there are many who say, look, Detroit needs new developments. It went so long without, and things are truly happening for the city. And they feared making developers strike a binding agreement with a neighborhood group would derail that progress.
We've heard for a long time that this is a fear tactic of jobs are going to leave. You know, no negotiations had happened, no conversations had happened. There was no threat to jobs because certainly Proposal A supports jobs, supports development happening in Detroit. I think what we see is that there was that something's wrong with the process in Detroit for development, that it's taking so long, that it's more costly. Perhaps we need to take a look at that. Our mayor should be examining why is development such a struggle in Detroit that it can't include community voice with something that's more powerful and more binding than just an advisory committee.
Can you, and the other organizers who pushed so hard for Proposal A, can you live with Proposal B?
Well, the battle's not really over yet. We have now 100,000 Detroit voters who believe in a more equitable plan, who think Proposal A was the way to go. So while Proposal B is on the books, it's only there for a year, and then things can be adjusted, things can be modified. So we'll be talking to the voters that stood with us as to how can we approach this? How do we move in the next year to make that proposal more equitable for all of us?
The Reverend Joan Ross, one of the leaders from Rise Together Detroit, which was the grassroots group behind Proposal A, which lost to Proposal B, the competing community benefits proposal. Thank you for being with us today, Reverend Ross.
Thanks, Cynthia. Thanks for caring about us.
I feel very embarrassed, if you want the honest truth, just due to the fact that the words that he says, the supporters, and just goes to show you that, you know, the people that were hiding of racism came out yesterday out of the rock just to show who they truly are.
I can't say that I'm surprised. I talk to a lot of people on a daily basis, and I can't say that I knew that Trump would win, but I felt very strongly about it.
I'm shocked. I'm scared. I hope that the election results will somehow, I don't know, settle down and people will come together. I don't know how that's going to work. But
I was basing everything on ideas of progress and linear thinking, which I think a lot of people who voted for Clinton thought like still worked, you know. But the fact is, it's not how history works. It's not a linear progress. We're not going towards some better thing. It's just history repeats itself over and over, just reconfigures itself.
I think he's going to make America great again.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and you just heard more reactions and thoughts about last night's election results from your fellow Michiganders. For a recap of election spending, the dollars and the cents in Michigan, we turn now to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network's Craig Mauger. Craig, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So let's first talk about the presidential campaign in Michigan, Craig. So we know over the last few weeks, Michigan suddenly became a battleground state, the bell of the campaign ball. We saw both candidates and their surrogates barnstorming across Michigan, rallying supporters and getting out the vote. How did that translate into campaign spending here?
Yeah, from what we can tell right now, that last week before the election on Tuesday, Michigan saw a ton of campaign spending. The candidates basically backed up a truck and dumped some money here. Hillary's campaign did the most spending. I think her campaign and her super PAC ran about $1.9 million in TV ads in Michigan over the seven-day period from November 1st to November 7th. Trump's campaign spent money here as well, running about $600,000 in broadcast ads from November 1st through November 7th. So that all amounts to 7,000 broadcast TV ads from those two campaigns.
I saw full-page newspaper ads, so we know they were buying print as well. Yeah, a lot of money spent. That was a major blitz, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a major blitz, and it came really late. I mean, it was just over that last 7 days. Basically, in October, Michigan didn't see any significant spending. In September, there was a small buy by the Trump campaign kind of early in September. But other than that, it was quiet here until that last week where things just really took off.
Now, as for the state house, Democrats were certainly believing they had a chance to take control, which obviously didn't happen. But that hope meant some pretty big spending in state house races. What are the numbers you have?
Yeah, we have a partial picture of what the overall spending is going to be at the end of the day. But right now, in the 16 state house races where there was significant spending happen, it amounts to about $12 million in spending. I think in 2014, there were three state house races that went over $1 million individually. This year, we could have possibly eight races go over $1 million, but very likely we'll have seven races. As it stands today, we don't have all the data in yet. We have five races that went over $1 million. So there was a ton of spending in these competitive races. But the thing is, and how crazy this election is, if you look at the races where the spending was happening, it doesn't really match up with the races that were really close. I mean, some of them do, but there are races that were among the top 10 closest races that weren't even receiving spending because things are just so askew from what the parties were expecting and what the people in general were expecting.
We also saw the three congressional races that were deemed to be super competitive. We saw the seventh, we saw the first, and the eighth, with the Republican candidates winning in all three. And were they hit hard by ads of the residents in those districts?
Oh, yeah. There was a ton of spending in the first, seventh, and eighth district. As it stands right now, the first district in northern Michigan has the distinction of being the one that received the most spending. Independent spenders, not the two candidate campaigns, dropped about $5 million in the first district. $5 million. And when you throw the campaigns in there, that is going to end up being somewhere around $8 to $9 million in total spending. The 7th and 8th saw an extreme amount of spending as well, not close to $8 million. I think the 7th is going to end up around $6 million, maybe $5 million when it's all said and done.
I know, Craig, by its very definition, the dark money is tough to track. But have you got any sense of just how much of it went into this election in Michigan, or maybe comparison to years prior?
I mean, it's difficult to compare dark money spending in Michigan because, like you said, it's hard to track. We're getting better at tracking it, though. I mean, we're getting better at figuring out ways we can put numeric values on the amount of dark money in our system. There was a lot of dark money this cycle. I think we've tracked at least $6 million in spending in state house races, the Supreme Court races, some other ads that were kind of geared at the presidential race and congressional races where Michiganders will not be able to know who wrote the checks to the groups that ran the ads. So that tracking is $6 million in dark money, and it's much more than that. We saw many mailers go out from mystery groups, robocalls go out from mystery groups, where Michiganders have no idea who's behind those robocalls, who's behind those mailers, but yet these groups are trying to influence voters.
And I saw your piece on your website for the Michigan Campaign Finance Network about the dark money spending for Prop A, the community benefits proposal in Detroit. That was a big player, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a lot of mystery money that went into defeating Prop A. I can't even wrap my arms around exactly how much money that group, Detroit Jobs First, spent. It seems pretty secretive at this moment. One day we will know, but right now it's a mystery. They were running lots of TV ads across all the different networks. They had a social media campaign. They were very active, but the public has no idea who's behind that group, and that's extremely unfortunate.
From a campaign finance point of view, Craig, what is your big takeaway, if you could sum it up in a sentence, from this year's election season?
Money is playing as large a role as it has in our political system. Some people may say, you know, look at Donald Trump. He didn't raise more money than Hillary Clinton, and he still won. But it seems to be a very isolated situation. There are examples from across the country, U.S. Senate races, the presidential primaries, where individual donors who could write checks of, you know, $5 million were holding sway and becoming more valuable to candidates than ever before. There was a competition for these large donors' support. And when candidates are competing for the support of a small group of large donors, it is not a positive thing for democracy.
Craig Mauger is with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Appreciate your time, Craig. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Donald Trump's victory is seen as one of the watershed moments in American political history, and Michigan voters played a role in this upset. Let's dive into what happened as we say hello to our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. What gave Michigan to a Republican and to Donald Trump?
That's the question, Cindy, that I think everyone is trying to figure out right now. What we're looking at is high turnout in counties that we weren't quite predicting, and those are rural white counties. And what we saw was in places like Wayne County, which went huge for President Obama in 08 and 12, simply didn't turn out for Hillary Clinton to make up for those votes for Trump throughout the rest of the state.
Which, Rick, I guess that completely fits into why we saw Bill Clinton making those trips to churches in Detroit and in Flint. And so that fit. There was a sense among
try to drive up that turnout. And, you know, we saw the results, not just in Donald Trump winning Michigan, but also Republicans retaining control of the State House of Representatives by the exact same margin that they have right now, which was wholly unexpected. But I think to look at it, you've got to dive all the way down to the bottom of the ballot. But let's start at the top. I am calling this a near sweep of minuscule proportions.
How so?
Trump won the state of Michigan.
Have you copyrighted that yet?
Not yet, but I'm running to the I'm running to the patent office. Trump won the state by 0.27%, a fraction of a percentage point. We have not had a race that close in Michigan since the 1940s when Wendell Willkie faced FDR. Now go all the way to the bottom of the ballot, to the State Board of Education, to the governing boards of Wayne State University, U of M, and MSU, which is our standard measure of baseline core party support. And we saw Republicans and Democrats in those races splitting those seats by vote totals, also separated by fractions of a percentage point. Very often, one Republican, one Democrat. Now we have to be careful because I think that sometimes we are a little too glib about splitting the public firmly into the R or the D columns, the Republicans or the Democrats. But what this says is, in Michigan at least, what we don't have is a consensus on governing, which means that both parties need to figure out how they're going to, you know, to capture a center-right or a center-left coalition if we are going to have stable governance in this state.
Absolutely. But some of this goes, I think, to just turnout and excitement. I mean, I want to cite this number. And again, these are unofficial. 425,000 fewer votes for Clinton than Obama in 2012. Half a million fewer votes than Obama, and then overall turnout, 215,000 votes. So absolutely, Rick, I mean, what you're talking about is an idea of, you know, splits between Republicans and Democrats. And these numbers that show me right now are, as for all of the get out the vote efforts and the excitement about presidential elections. And Rick and I will continually say that Michigan is a Democratic state. The fact is, Democrats don't turn out. That is what happened again here, that turnout was not what folks are used to in presidential elections in Michigan.
And I think one of the big questions here that both parties are going to have to confront, and you know, all kinds of different people vote for all kinds of different reasons, but I'm wondering, writ large, are we seeing a public that voted its aspirations, or did we see a public that voted its fears, because the political class in Lansing and in Washington is going to have to respond in different ways depending on what motivated voters in this cycle.
Oh, absolutely. And this goes to the dynamic of Donald Trump overall talking about the nation, that we have economic worries and that, you know, make America great again, this idea that the economy isn't nearly where it should be. But of course, Republicans in Michigan running on the fact that Republicans have been in charge in all of chambers of government.
And we're the comeback state.
And that we're the comeback state, and Republicans have fixed things. And all along, we've had these two differing narratives. And yet voters basically said we're OK with that conflict and we want to keep going forward.
When I think of the surprise factor of, wow, many didn't see this coming. What does this upset tell us about the things that we thought we knew?
Well, really, Cindy, I mean, I think really we should have been unsurprised that there were continuing surprises in 2016. Mm-hmm. It feels like every time we were surprised, right, in March, when Bernie Sanders won the Michigan Democratic primary, when Donald Trump showed nationally he was doing so well, when folks, you know, a year ago were writing him off, I think probably what we should have reminded ourselves was, you know what, this has been 16, 18, 24 months of surprises. And so the fact that a shock came on election night, I guess, isn't so shocking after all.
I want to talk about some of the congressional races because we have some new faces.
We do. So the numbers have remained the same, right? So Michigan continuing to send 9 Republicans to D.C., 5 Democrats in terms of the congressional delegation, but some new faces. Jack Bergman, a Republican in the 1st Congressional District. So that is the upper northern Michigan UP district, the largest district in terms of just actual physical size east of the Mississippi. And I'll tell you, Cindy, we were talking before we started taping. I took a trip into that area a few weeks ago, and that was the first time that I really hit me how far and wide and deep the Trump support was up north. I mean, obviously, the UP, rural northern Michigan, tends to go Republican, at least in the past few election cycles. But I think it really hit me there, seeing just these rolling hills, right, of northern Michigan, driving up and down and just for miles, seeing Trump-Pence signs. And that then helped the Jack Bergman in the 1st Congressional District. And then, Rick, of course, we had the 7th and 8th.
Mm-hmm. Where you know, basically the incumbents won. And over in the Thumb area, Paul Mitchell finally found a congressional seat that he could win. So he will be a freshman headed to Washington. But getting, you know, back to Zoe's point and all of this about, you know, sort of two Michigans, that a lot of attention has been paid on the national level about Republicans' apparent inability to appeal to urban voters and what that means for the present and the future of the party. But that also, you know, what we've seen in this cycle is the Democrats' inability to reach rural voters. And I think, at least in Lansing, if Democrats are going to have any hopes of being a majority party in the state, that they're going to have to learn how to win more races north of Clare.
One just final thoughts, if we can, on the state house where the GOP stays in control. I know there was, you know, certainly the down ballot question did not play any role here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, Rick and I, as you know, as early as a few days ago, we're talking about what if it was a 55-55 split. Michigan Republicans will continue their control of the state house. They will elect a new speaker of the house. But this will basically continue the status quo here in Michigan, as you've got the entire state Senate now and the state house Republican controlled. And of course, the executive under Governor Rick Snyder for the next 2 years.
Is it too early to
I would submit to you that even though we're seeing a continuation of partisan authority in Lansing, that I think the landscape is actually less predictable than it was the day before yesterday. And here's why. I would turn your attention to the vote in Southeast Michigan about the Regional Transit Authority, which was rejected by voters overall in the region. Now, this has been a big priority of the Metro Detroit business community and of Governor Rick Snyder. And the fact that once again, voters have come back and said no to a proposed solution on that, I think sends a message to the political class that voters are fickle right now. And everyone had better pay attention to that.
Well, I think it just goes exactly back to Prop 1. I mean, there are all, which was in increasing money throughout the state for roads that just disastrously, sort of spectacularly failed, which had the business community, Governor Snyder behind. This is in itself, in just kind of, you know, blank, naked analysis, a vote against the establishment. And RTA, in some ways, was part of that, the regional transportation vote.
Absolutely.
The idea that folks coming together, and this is folks saying, we are tired of the establishment, you know, the Trump folks saying, the drain the swamp, right? We got to get rid of those folks in D.C., a lot of talk, but this was the vote that is doing it in some respects. And a President Trump, just the sound of that, right, is the idea in its absolute, you know, bold flashing lights that this is what the majority of voters chose, at least including the Electoral College. We are, of course, still counting the popular vote right now.
Well, much to chew over and will be in the future as everything unwinds and becomes more clear. And we will be back again to our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. As always, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Cindy.
Always a pleasure.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Our show's director today, Mike Blank. Our engineer, Rusty Brock. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, Liz Dickey, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.